Thanks very much, Victoria. So what I want to talk to you today is about something which I very much expect that you're aware of and something you should be paying attention to over the year ahead. So I'm going to talk about interest rate benchmarks, not necessarily what you were expecting I was going to say. So there's recently been some pretty important developments internationally in particular, but as, also here in Australia. And as you're all probably aware, interest rate, these benchmarks are at the heart of the plumbing of the financial system. They're widely referenced in financial contracts. There's only around about $300 trillion worth of contracts which reference interest rate benchmarks. Corporate borrowing rates are often priced as a spread to an interest rate benchmark. So as you may know, in light of the issues around LIBOR and other benchmarks that have arisen over the past decade, there's been an ongoing global reform effort to improve the functioning of interest rate benchmarks. One thing I want to highlight today is a recent announcement by Andrew Bailey, who's head of the FCA in the UK, on the future of LIBOR, and also talk about the implications of this for Australian financial markets. And then also summarise the current state of play in Australia, particularly for the major interest rate benchmark here, BBSW, where the aim is to ensure that BBSW remains a robust benchmark for the long term. And also, the other issue I want to talk about is the important role for risk-free rates as an alternative to credit-based benchmarks such as BBSW and LIBOR. But let me start with LIBOR. So LIBOR is the key interest rate benchmark for several major currencies, including most obviously the US dollar and sterling, as well as Japan, Europe and Switzerland. Just over a month ago, Andrew Bailey, who, as I said, heads the FCA, which is the body responsible for regulating LIBOR, raised some serious questions about the sustainability or even the longevity of LIBOR. So the key problem he identified, which has been known for some time, is that there just aren't enough transactions in the short-term wholesale funding market today for banks to anchor the benchmark. So the banks that make the submissions that are used to calculate LIBOR are uncomfortable about continuing to do so, as they have to rely mainly on their expert judgment in determining where LIBOR should be on any given day rather than on actual transactions. So to prevent LIBOR from abruptly ceasing to exist, the FCA has received assurances from the current banks on their LIBOR panel that they will continue to submit their estimates to sustain LIBOR until the end of 2021, which doesn't sound imminent, but it's going to take a while for people to sort stuff out between now and the end of 2021. Beyond that point, beyond the end of 2021, there is no guarantee that LIBOR will continue to exist at all. The FCA will not compel banks to provide submissions, and the panel banks who are on the LIBOR panel currently may not voluntarily continue to do so. So there is no guarantee of longevity. This four-year notice period should give market participants enough time to transition away from LIBOR, but the process will not be easy. Market participants that use LIBOR, including those in Australia, need to work on transitioning their contracts to alternative reference rates. So this is a significant issue. As I said earlier, LIBOR is referenced in around about $350 trillion worth of contracts globally. So a decently large share of these contracts have short durations, often 3 months or less, but there is a very sizable share of current contracts which extend beyond 2021. And, you know, for instance, there is a number of contracts which last around about 100 years, which reference LIBOR. This is also an issue in Australia, where we estimate that financial institutions here have around $5 trillion worth of contracts which reference LIBOR. So finding a replacement for LIBOR is not straightforward. Regulators around the world have been working closely with the industry to identify alternative risk-free rates that can be used instead of LIBOR, and working with ISDA to strengthen the fallback provisions that would apply in contracts if LIBOR was to be discontinued. That transition will involve a substantial amount of work for users of LIBOR, both to amend contracts and update systems. So there was one industry which was going to do extremely well out of all of this, as it is often the case, which would be the legal industry. The equivalent interest rate benchmark for the Australian dollar is BBSW. And the Council of Financial Regulators has been working closely with industry for some time to ensure that it remains a robust financial benchmark, and so to ensure that it doesn't have a longevity problem. So as you may know, BBSW is currently calculated from executable bids and offers for bills issued by the major banks. A major concern over recent years has been the low trading volumes at the time of day that BBSW is measured, which is around 10 o'clock. So there are two key steps that are currently being taken to support BBSW. First, the methodology is being strengthened to enable the benchmark to be calculated directly from a wider set of market transactions than just those which go through the window at around a minute either side of 10. And second, there is also a new regulatory framework for financial benchmarks which is being introduced. So the work on strengthening the BBSW methodology is progressing well. So the ASX, which is now the administrator of BBSW, has been working closely with market participants and the regulators on finalising the details of the new methodology. So this will involve calculating BBSW as the volume weighted average price, or VWAP, of bank bill transactions. It will cover a wider range of institutions during a longer trading window. So the ASX has been consulting market participants also on a new set of trading guidelines for bank bills, and this process has the strong support of the Council of Financial Regulators. The new arrangements will not only anchor BBSW to a larger set of transactions, but is also going to improve the infrastructure in the bank bill market, encouraging more electronic trading and straight-through processing of transactions. So the critical difference between BBSW and LIBOR is that here, ironically enough, there are enough transactions in the local bank bill market each day, whereas in the LIBOR market, there are not. And that's got something to do with the idiosyncrasies of the nature of the bank bill market here and that in other jurisdictions. But there are enough transactions here in the market to enable a robust benchmark to be calculated. For the new BBSW methodology to be implemented successfully, the institutions that participate in the bank bill market will need to start trading them at outright yields rather than the current practice of agreeing to the transaction at the yet-to-be-determined BBSW rate. So the market will actually have to get used to transacting at a price, which is, somewhat a foreign concept, but anyway. This change of behaviour needs to occur at the banks that issue the bank bills, as well as those that buy them, including the investment funds and Treasury Corps. And the RBA is also playing its part in the sense that market participants have asked us to move our open market operations to a slightly earlier time to support liquidity in the bank bill market during the trading window, and we have agreed to do this. So while we all have to make some changes to the systems, including us at the Reserve Bank, and practices to support the new methodology, the investment in a more robust BBSW will be well worth it. The alternative of rewriting a very large number of contracts and re-engineering systems should BBSW cease to exist would be considerably more painful. I think you can do the cost-benefit analysis pretty easily. The new regulatory framework for financial benchmarks that the government is in the process of introducing should provide market participants with more certainty. So Treasury recently completed a consultation on the draft legislation and that actually was read into Parliament yesterday. In addition, ASIC recently released more detail about how the regulatory regime would be implemented. And this should help to address the uncertainty that institutions participating in the rate set process have been facing. It also should help the continued use of BBSW in the European Union, where new regulations will soon come into force that require benchmarks used in the EU, which includes BBSW, to be subject to a robust regulatory framework. So while the new VWAP methodology will help ensure that BBSW remains a robust benchmark, it is important for market participants to also ask whether BBSW is the most appropriate benchmark to actually be using. For some financial products, it does make sense to reference a risk-free rate rather than a credit-based reference rate. For instance, FRNs issued by governments and non-financial corporations and securitisation trusts, which are currently priced at a spread to BBSW, could instead tie their coupon payments to the cash rate, the risk-free rate. However, for other products, it does make sense to continue referencing a credit-based benchmark, particularly anything involving a bank or a product issued by a bank. The counterparties to these products would still need derivatives that reference BBSW so that they can hedge their interest rate exposures. But it is also prudent for users of any benchmark to have planned for a scenario where the benchmark no longer exists. The general approach that has been taken internationally to address the risk of benchmarks, such as LIBOR being discontinued, is to develop risk-free benchmarks. And as I said, we've already got one here, which is called the cash rate, but a number of jurisdictions, including the UK and the US, have only just recently announced their preferred risk-free rates in the last month or so. One issue that is yet to be resolved is all the rates that have been announced so far are just overnight rates, whereas most benchmarks are a term rate. The term market for these products is yet to be developed, although one could expect them to occur through time. Another complication is that risk-free rates are not equivalent across jurisdictions. Some reference an unsecured rate, including here in Australia and also the UK, while in the US, for instance, they're referencing a secured rate, the repo rate. So as the RBA's operational target for monetary policy and the reference rate for OIS and other financial contracts, the cash rate is the risk-free interest rate benchmark for the Australian dollar. We, the RBA, measure the cash rate directly from transactions in the interbank overnight cash market, and we have ensured that our methodology is in line with the IOSCO benchmark principles. However, the cash rate is not a perfect substitute for BBSW. As I said, it's an overnight rate rather than a term rate, and it doesn't incorporate a significant bank credit risk premium. So let me just finish by making the three main points I'd like you to take away with you concerning interest rate benchmarks. First, and probably most importantly, the longevity of LIBOR cannot be assumed. And you should start, if you haven't already, considering today what that might mean for any contracts that you have that reference LIBOR. Second, and in stark contrast, we are well advanced in changes to enhancing the longevity of BBSW. While these changes entail some costs, the cost of not doing so would be considerably larger. And third, you should think hard whether risk-free benchmarks are the most are more appropriate rates for your financial contracts to reference rather than credit-based benchmarks such as LIBOR and BBSW.
So thank you to each of you for outlining those sort of key issues and priorities. I'd like to kick off the Q&A with a question about Australia in a global context, and through all of your roles you have that perspective. The Australian banking financial services sector seemed to come through the GFC largely unscathed, certainly from a prudential and system stability perspective. Do you think the industry here failed to see some of the changes that needed to be made following the GFC and so perhaps is behind in some areas from the rest of the world in how it operates? I'm happy to... Wayne, you look like you want to answer that question, so I'm going to throw to you.
Guy and I were seeing whether the other one would answer it first. But I'm happy to have first go at it. I guess I would make the observation that we, Australia, did come through the financial crisis quite well relative to others. I don't think there's any doubt about that. No one would really dispute that. I think there were three core reasons for that. One was actually the industry was reasonably well managed in the period leading up to the crisis, so that's a good thing. Secondly, though, there was a huge amount of public sector support thrown in through government stimulus, monetary policy responses, short selling bans. There were a whole raft of public sector intervention to help keep the system stable and able to function. And then the third thing was there was just an element of good luck. And I suspect as we reflect on that, the second and the third issues are often downplayed. And so we should be very comfortable and happy that we survived far better than many other jurisdictions. The cost to the community of the crisis has been far less here than it's been in many other countries. But it's not that the industry did it itself. There was a lot of public sector help and there was just an element of good luck. And good luck primarily in the form of a Chinese economy that pulled us forward. So I do think those two issues around public sector support and an element of luck are often downplayed and so maybe that has left us with a bit of a blind spot or a bit of complacency. I don't think there's complacency in the regulatory sector, but possibly in the industry, yes.
I mean, the only thing I would add, though, is I do think if you look at something like, well, in Wayne's territory, around some of the financial regulatory changes in the banking system in terms of things like the LCR, the NSFR, even the yet-to-be-finalised Basel III standards, then partly as, you know, APRA has been certainly in the vanguard of doing that, and our banking system's adapted to that. So that if you know, I think it's when you say failed to see some of the changes that needed to be made, I mean, most of the global industry failed to see some of the changes. But if you look at where we are today in terms of adjusting business models in response to those changes, then I think we're in an okay place. We're not necessarily in the best place. We're in an okay place. I mean, I think the most starkest contrast is between here and in Europe, where I would think a number of those regulatory changes I just talked about are yet to actually take effect in Europe. But they are fully effective here, and business models and practices have adjusted to that. So, I think the response here compared to some other jurisdictions has been reasonably timely.
Yep. Greg, your view on where we stand now, and I don't necessarily reflecting on where the regulators stand compared to international regulation, but where the industry is at today compared to overseas?
I think I agree with Wayne. I think we were very lucky in 07. Also, the other big thing is we had something called superannuation, which probably bailed out a lot of the banks because of the ability to issue equity at a discount, in addition to the other things that Wayne said. So in addition to, I think, good regulation, but I think, again, as always, we're a lucky country. But I think the three things that are critical, I think, since then is, first of all, I think, and Australia's probably not the only one, is that I think the social licence has moved, and I think the banks have failed to recognise that the social licence has moved. And I think that is their big problem. And it's not just an Australian phenomenon, it's around the world. And that has actually, I think, resulted in a really high, a lower level of trust. Mm. So I think rebuilding that trust, if it can be built, is going to be a big challenge, as it is quite low. Second thing I think that has changed, that happened in 07, is I think there was something happening in 07 that we didn't notice because actually it was happening, we had the crisis, but technology has, was a big inflection point in 07 because if you think about it, in 07 was when MWare was developed, which enabled cloud computing. We had Hadoop developed, which enabled big data analysis. Google released their Android operating system. IBM Watson was launched. Amazon Kindle was launched, Airbnb was started. So there was this technological revolution actually that happened, starting to really take off in 07, that actually in parallel it was this crisis. And I think really the other big thing I think challenges the banks, or will challenge them, is with the lowering of trust, where I guess the technology revolution thrives is where there is a massive deficit of trust. So I think, social license, technology, the technological revolution, I think, and also I think as part of that is frankly the power of the crowd. Today you cannot hide from the crowd. It's constant and you just got to get over it, and that's the way things are today. So I do think it is challenging and it has moved a lot.
It's a good segue into a question I've got about the issues of trust, and David in his introduction talked about the Edelman report and what it indicated in terms of the low levels of community trust and confidence in the sector. I should say there have been small improvements which were pointed out to me over the last year, but I suspect it's going to take quite a long time to really rebuild trust. It won't happen overnight. So what do you think, and actually I'll start with you, Greg, now, what is it that the financial services industry could really do more of to restore that trust as quickly as possible, but also sustainably?
Look, I think that certainly got a long way to go, and I think about financial advice, responsible lending, general insurance, life insurance, bank bills, FX. So it's not a particularly pretty report card. I just don't hope there's not another one around the corner. So I think, I was saying to David before, I think they always underwhelm in responding. That's their problem. They always underwhelm. And I think, as said David before, I think you've actually got to do something that they don't expect, something that actually goes, oh, they've changed, because the moment they're actually playing catch-up. So I think if you've got to change expectations, you've got to go beyond what people expect. Now, what do you need to do? If you push the button, there's another slide there, and I think it's actually about what good looks like, okay? One of the things we set out for the first time last year in the 20 sectors that we regulate
is what we think good looks like. And I think that's what that's how you can improve trust and confidence. You know, treating customers fairly, right? Making sure that you've got products that actually are properly designed, properly targeted. Thinking about if something goes wrong, actually that you'll actually deal with complaints quickly and efficiently. Frankly, it's quite common sense. It's frankly, if you think about it, summarising it, it's frankly about doing the right thing by your customer. And as I said to people, said many to the, you know, banks, boards, whatever, you've actually got to have a culture your customers can believe in. And what I think their problem today is they keep saying these words, but the people of Australia go, well, this is empty. Like, what about what you've just done? So I think, you know, and I do think it was quite interesting, the overnight, I think the Today's Financial Review, the comment, the gentleman from, from Bridgewater talking about culture, you know, you've got to have a culture people can believe in. That means sometimes challenging the people at the top about what they're doing. So I do think there's a lot to do in this area, and we do need, the biggest asset the banks have is trust.
Okay. I'm going to throw the audience in just one moment for questions, so be ready. Any additions to that, Guy or Wayne? You know, how can we really kind of have that major step forward?
Well, I don't know. There's no quick fix here because it's a deep-seated issue now in the view of the community that there is this lack of trust. So there's no, it's taken a long time to get to this point. There's no quick fix to quickly rectify it. So the emphasis is more on how do you do it sustainably. And I would just pick up the one thing I'd emphasise that Greg's already touched on is the issue of transparency. Being willing to transparently talk about problems and what you're doing in response to them rather than hoping that no one finds out. And if you think about many of the issues that are now, you know, generating headlines and public debate about, many of them happened 3 or 4 years ago. No one revealed them. A more proactive approach to saying we have an issue, we find it, we report it, we fix it, and if necessary, we compensate whoever lost out. And doing that in a much more proactive way rather than waiting for someone to find out before we do anything is clearly an essential part of
going.
I think that's absolutely the main point. Picking up on what Wayne said, being proactive rather than, at the moment, it's sort of a defensive response which just doesn't help, I would say. Yeah. And the other thing which I think Greg alluded to is that this sort of drip feed of issue after issue after issue just reinforces the belief or the view that's out there. And, you know, it's the constancy of a different issue servicing with a different dimension across all aspects of what the financial sector does, which I think very much exacerbates the problem. So no one feels that anything particularly has changed because even if the issue occurred a few years ago, it still, you know, it generates the headlines today and just reinforces that belief. So, you know, it would be very nice to have some comfort that actually the cupboard is now bare, not in Wayne's sense.
the other cupboard, bad cupboard, not the good cupboard.
That there isn't anything more which is going to come and just further undermine that lack of trust in the industry and really making sure, as I said, it's not a defensive response, but it's actually getting out there in front of it.
Thanks. I'm now going to ask for questions from the audience. So if you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand, but remember, wait for the microphone to come to you and do state your name and organisation. And please ask a question, don't make a speech. So we have a question here. We've got the microphone coming right behind you. Thank you.
Thank you. That was really quick. My name's Edward Buckingham. I head up the Australian Centre for Financial Studies. I'm a professor at Monash University. Greg, I think many of us were both excited and absolutely terrified by the prospect of all this data that you're going to have.
Can come and share it if you like.
Well, that's where I was going, Greg, because my suspicion...
Well, let's put him down for sharing data. No. Sorry.
My suspicion is that it's actually even going to be too big even for ASIC. And I'd like to hear more about what you think about how you're going to govern it, how you're going to marshal
the analytical capabilities of industry, but also, very importantly, the universities, which in my opinion are far too focused on the United States and Europe, should be focused on Australian problems. How are you going to go about that?
So, well, it's nothing really. First of all, we already deal with massive amounts of data. Have a talk to the banks we investigated on BBSW. We have terabytes of data. We're probably one of the leading agencies in Australia in terms of evidence services and dealing with massive amounts of data. So dealing with data is nothing new. The big problem for us at times is the way the data comes to us, because it's not really structured data, it's unstructured data. So what would make things a lot easier is actually we had a lot more structured data. But equally, if we weren't actually every time we have something, we can actually issue huge amounts of notices to try and think about it. Think about data. Having good data is actually, as I say, being able to remove some of the hay to find the needle. So actually having data that actually we is real data that we actually can use makes things a lot easier for everyone. In terms of your question, in terms of use of data, and to that point, we're rolling out Microsoft Dynamics CRM across ASIC at the moment, single database, common names for things, just sort of the fundamental sort of hygiene stuff. And as I said, we are about to release our data strategy, which goes to the whole issue of how we intend to govern data. The other thing about our data is actually we're starting to use external data sets rather than even our own data. So thinking about, you know, how we can get the data that, you know, we exchange, we say, with our system now, we're using, say, Morningstar data or Bloomberg data, and we're actually bringing that into our analysis, so rather than requesting data. We're getting data sets from people like ATO, getting more data. So rather than trying to recreate the wheel, thinking, before we actually, that's why we created the role of Chief Data Officer, to actually think in one point, what do we actually need to request of a party? Is there another way of actually getting access to that intelligence or not? But in terms of systems, you know, we actually are doing a fair bit in terms of our, if you want, you know, if I break it into e-investigations. So at the moment we're using a thing called IBM i2, which many of you may know, which actually allows us to actually create, essentially take the data we have into effectively a data lake, and actually allows us to establish contacts between either between people, entities, or locations. And that is incredibly efficient. Something to connect people, like an insider trading, that might have taken us 6 months to see before. Recently, we had a case that took us 2 hours to connect the dots. And it's visual, you know, identification. So, and we'll be giving a presentation at the Parliament in a few weeks' time. You know, at the moment, also, we're starting to look at the issue of predictive behavioural data analytics, and we're working with some suppliers on that. We've got a venture with Data 61 at the moment, academic, I guess, where, in fact, we're actually trialling using machine learning in terms of the funds management sector. In enforcement now, we basically, when we look at data, we have for a number of years used NUIX, which is, again, machine learning technology that actually uses pattern recognition to identify commonality between documents. So that's just some examples. One of the other ones we're using at the moment is RedMarker, which actually then uses machine learning to actually trawl across the web to identify unlicensed behaviour by accountants, for example, and then comes back to us. Or we're using Crimson Hexagon, which is social media data analytics. You actually can go back 10 years and actually identify your behaviour on social media, including if you've removed posts, okay? So, it, you know, just remind you all, you don't get away with it. But
you can run, but you cannot hide.
I guess the key point is there is an amazing revolution happening with data. Privacy is important. But, hey, this is about us catching crooks, okay? So people that break the law. Now, what we're doing is what other law enforcement agencies are doing. So, but it's got to have the right governance around it. But what it will mean is it makes it far faster for us to detect misconduct. So, but as I say, we are working with a lot of academic agencies.
Thanks. Another question from the audience? One back here.
Hi, Harvey Choke, ex-private banker. My question is on cryptocurrencies as to how we're going to regulate them in future.
Sorry, I couldn't.
Could you repeat the question?
For cryptocurrencies, how are we going to regulate them in future?
Cryptocurrencies and how they're going to be regulated in the future.
My view is that first of all, I think that you saw this week the Chinese have actually banned ICOs, okay? And we've said we'll be issuing a paper very soon on ICOs. It's something we've discussed previously at the board of IOSCO, and you know whether in fact they're a financial product depends on what the conditions of the ICO are. But more broadly, in terms of digital currencies, my own view is that, frankly, if central banks issue ultimately their own fiat digital currencies, you know, there's probably a good case to actually ban non-central bank digital issued currencies, because what it probably means is they're being used for illicit purposes. So, you know, either for tax avoidance or for organised crime. So, yeah, but as far as strict regulation at the moment, we do regulate them in terms of if there's a trading in them on an organised market. But I think it's a work in progress. But as I say, ICOs are something we'll issue some guidance about pretty soon.
Guy, do you have a view on cryptocurrencies?
I don't actually quite agree with Greg about central bank. He said earlier about central banks having an account with everyone in Australia can have an account with the central bank. Central banks were actually created to stop exactly the problem that would result from that when they were created at least a few years ago, which is you'd have these massive swings in liquidity in and out of the core part of the system. But that said, I think partly to Greg's point, I think one thing we are looking at quite a bit at the bank at the moment is around digital currencies as a means of payment rather than as a store of value. And I think at the moment we have a somewhat open mind as to whether that's provided by the private sector or whether there's a role for the public sector to do so in terms of providing a sort of token means, a digital token means of exchange. I think is something we're very much interested mm-hmm. at the moment and seeing how that plays out. And there may or may not be a role for the public sector mm-hmm. in doing so. But as I said, that's very much as a means of payment rather than as a store of value. Okay.
Thanks. There was a question down here, I think. We had here the microphone.
Michael Cunningham, KPMG. A question for Wayne. The counter-cyclical buffer is currently set at zero at the bottom of the range. What scenarios, and of course hypothetically speaking, is APRA looking at that would change that buffer?
So the first thing to say is there isn't a sort of mechanical way of responding to that buffer. The buffer is a new part of the Basel framework, for those that don't know it, that essentially says in good times you should get banks to put a bit more capital away for a rainy day. And broadly speaking, it is described as when would you use it? You would use it in periods of excessive credit growth, broadly defined. What that mean? Well, that's in the eye of the beholder, obviously. What is excessive credit growth? We've been very careful not to prescribe, you know, it is credit growth above X percent. So we have published, though, a set of indicators that we look at. Again, it's not formulaic, it's not mechanical, but we do look at things, you know, how is housing credit growth going, how is business credit growth going, what's the extent to which there's leverage financing happening, what's happening to asset prices. There's a raft of indicators we look at. Internally, we have a sort of quarterly exercise that we look at those things on a semi-annual basis. We talk about it at the Council of Financial Regulators. And then annually, we've only done one because we've only had it in place for 1 year, but a bit over 1 year. Annually, we put out a kind of a report card that says, here's how we see, you know, here's our judgment, because at the end of the day, it's a judgment. So the answer to your question, you know, what's the trigger? Well, it'll be a sort of judgment of a raft of people looking at a range of indicators rather than, okay, it hits the, you know, credit growth hits this point and it's switched on.
Thank you. One more question. We have time for one more question. Down here.
A question for Wayne. Wayne, it's Scott Murdoch from The Australian.
When you mentioned in your speech the role of boards dealing with their executives, and you said it's your preference that boards take responsibility for their executives, do you think that is increasingly more important that that's the case, particularly in light of what we have seen with CBA over the past month?
Well, I'm not going to comment on any individual company. I just think, and the new regime that the government announced is obviously announced some months ago now, It was May, the budget. So it is not a response to the most recent issues that have dominated headlines. It's part of this broader issue, I think, Victoria started questioning us on about community trust in the financial system and a desire or a perception that accountability in the banking system has not been what the broader community expects it to have been, and therefore a political and regulatory response that says we need to do something to kind of reinforce appropriate governance, appropriate structures and appropriate accountability within the banking system. So it's not a response to the most recent issue. I think it's really just trying to reinforce good corporate governance, good corporate practice. In fact, not doing anything more than, I suspect, what has always traditionally been the corporation's role, job of boards of directors. Mm. But it is happening in an environment in which, as I said, there is this concern amongst the community that accountability hasn't been perhaps as clear or at least transparent as it might have been. And so there's a desire just to reinforce that and make it a bit clearer.
Thank you. Well, to ensure that we get you all out of here on time, we'll finish the questions there and thank the panel very much for their responses. Thank you.